We hope this message from Word of Life Church and Pastor Brian Zahn is a blessing to you. If you'd like to help support these Word of Life podcasts, please go to the Contributions tab at WOLC.com.
Book of Job, please. Have you ever read the Book of Job? Not just bits and parts of it, not just the first two chapters and the last chapter, but the whole thing? Job chapter 21, verse 1. Then Job spoke again. Listen closely to what I am saying. That's one consolation you can give me. Bear with me and let me speak. And after I have spoken, you may resume mocking me. Poor Job. The book of Job is one of the most remarkable achievements in Scripture. It's an epic poem dealing with the very deepest issues of faith and humanity. You know the story that sets up the poem. Job was a righteous man. You need to know that. He wasn't a wicked man, he was a righteous man. He was a wealthy man. And he became the center of a dispute between God and the accuser, Satan. And Job accused, or rather, Satan accused Job of serving God only for what he could get out of it, not having any genuine love, faithfulness, or devotion to God. And so Satan was permitted to attack Job. And in the course of these vicious attacks, Job lost everything. He lost his wealth, he lost his health, and he lost his family. Only his wife was spared, and she was the one that tempted him to curse God and die. And then we find Job sitting in the ashes, scraping the boils off of his flesh with a shard of pottery. One of the most poignant and almost heart-wrenching pictures that you can imagine. A man who has lost everything. Three of his friends come to see him. They will earn the title miserable comforters. Eliphaz and Zophar. I can't remember their names. There's another one. Their names are basically immaterial. Bildad. And they come, and instead of really comforting Job, what they attempt to do, and beware, beware, beware of doing this, they attempt to explain why this has happened to Job. When you go to comfort somebody that has suffered a horrible loss, is going through a terrible trial, beware of showing up as an expert to explain to them why this has happened and now what they need to do to get out of it. Just be there and grieve with them, love them, support them, be their friend. Don't be there as the expert to explain everything. But that's what they tried to do. And ultimately, their argument was, Job, you must have done something to deserve this. There must be some action in your past that accounts for this horrible thing coming on you, because certainly God is righteous and God is, you know, the protector, and he wouldn't have allowed this to happen except you had messed up somehow. And in the course of their dialogues, Job gives 10 impassioned, each one becoming more passionate, and it's being ratcheted up higher and higher. 10 times Job defends himself and says, no, I'm a righteous man. I did nothing to deserve this. Eventually, a young man, Elihu, comes and brings a little bit of a different perspective, but the real climactic moment is when God himself appears. And then Job responds to God in a different manner. And eventually, in the end, God restores to him his losses. Now, part of the appeal of the poem of Job is its brutal honesty. There's nothing trite about it. Brutally honest in addressing the problem of evil. The biggest question addressed in the book of Job is this: why do bad things happen to good people? How many of you know that that does occur? Why do bad, and I'm afraid even just to breathe, I'm afraid to say, why do bad things happen to good people, for fear that some of you sitting out there will be a Bildad or a Zophar and will attempt to give an answer. The book of Job offers no cheap or simplistic answers as to why this world is so often filled with misery and pain and evil and sorrow and suffering. I'll say the book of Job offers no cheap or simplistic answers. I think I could push it further and basically say the book of Job offers no answers at all. Consider Job's perspective. Job knows that he is an innocent man, at least on a relative scale. Compared to other people, he has lived a righteous life. Job also knows that God knows all of this and that God is all powerful. So what does Job know? He knows I'm a righteous man. God knows I'm a righteous man. And God is all powerful. So all I can get out of this is that God has allowed the righteous to suffer unjustly, and he's quite upset about it. Make no mistake about that. He's quite upset about it. And Job is not hesitant to question God. His question essentially is, where were you? Why have you allowed this to happen to me? Where were you, God? Where were you? And Job goes even further in these 10 speeches and eventually dances on the edge of accusing God of injustice. Never comes right out and says it, but he gets very close to it. At the very least, Job thinks that God ought to be held accountable for his creation. God, you're the creator. You're the one that has made all this. It seems to all be going wrong. What do you have to say about it? A creation that seems too full of pain and suffering and terrible injustice. Now, nice Christians may not ask these questions. Nice, got all the answers figured out. Christians may not ask these hard questions. But Job did. And the poets have not stopped asking the obvious and inescapable question, where is God in a world gone wrong? And by the way, a footprints in the sand poem isn't much help. If that was the answer, God would have put it in the Bible. It's not in the Bible. It's in some dumb bookstore near you. And it's not a very good answer. Today's song comes from the group The Fray. Interestingly, when I announced this series, even though I said I'd already picked out all the songs, people nevertheless sent in suggestions. And the most suggested group was, in fact, The Fray. The kids just love them. And they're the youngest of the artists, I think. Well, Regina Spektor's pretty, they're all about the same age, Regina Spektor and The Fray. And they're from Denver, Colorado. They all grew up going to Faith Christian Academy in Denver. They're Christians. It's not a Christian band, but it's just a band. But they're all Christians. They were worship leaders in their church. And in 2005, they released their first album, How to Save a Life. Garnered a lot of critical acclaim, both for its music and its lyrics. And then in February of this year, they released their self-titled sophomore album, simply entitled The Fray, and it debuted at number one and has sold millions and millions of copies. The song that I've picked off of that album is You Found Me. The song is written from the perspective of a person who is suffering tremendous pain because they've lost a loved one, presumably through death. And the song is about finding God and being found by God, but also asking God some hard questions. There's a bit of an accusatory tone there. God, I found you, you found me, but it seems a little late. Where were you when all this was going on? You'll hear the line in there. He finds God and he says, I said, where you been? And God says, he said, ask anything. And the question that is asked of God is, where were you when everything was falling apart? All right, I'm going to show you a video of the song. I noticed when I was looking at this yesterday on YouTube that it's in the last couple of months it's been viewed 18 million times. So, you know, welcome to our world. And so check out the song, and it ties in with Job. I'll come back and see if we can get some answers from this question. But here's the song, "You Found Me."
I found God on the corner of First and Amistad, where the West was all but one. All alone, smoking his last cigarette, I said, "Where you been?" He said, "Ask anything."
That's the fray asking the same question and raising the same complaint as Job. Lyrics like, "Lost and insecure, you found me lying on the floor, surround me, why'd you have to wait? Where were you? Just a little late, you found me, why'd you have to wait to find me?" And if you think, well, that's a bit strong, well, it's no stronger than Job. Job, chapter 21, we'll keep going. He says in verse 4, "My complaint is with God, not with people. I have good reason to be so impatient. Where were you? Where were you? Look at me and be stunned. Now Job's talking to you. He says, look at me and be stunned. Put your hand over your mouth in shock. When I think about what I'm saying, I shudder. My body trembles. Job realizes that what he's doing is dangerous. He's questioning God. Where were you? He says, I know it's shocking that I'm talking like this, but my complaint is not with people. My complaint is with God. I know it's shocking. It scares me even as I say it. Job says, my body trembles. My complaint is with God. Where was he? Of course, nobody else has ever felt that way. Interestingly, eventually God does make an appearance in this drama. Let's look at it. It's in Job 38. Where were you? Where were you? Where were you? Where were you? My complaint is with God. I have a right to be impatient. Where were you? Where were you? Finally, God shows up. Not at the corner of First and Amistad, but he shows up to meet Job. And he says, chapter 38, verse 1, then the Lord appeared to Job from the whirlwind. Who is this that questions my wisdom with such ignorant words? Brace yourself like a man because I have some questions for you and you must answer them. Where were you when I laid the foundation of the earth? Tell me if you know so much. To the question that Job, and for that matter the Frey and millions of others have raised, to the question, where were you? God gives no answer. He simply raises his own question, where were you? When I was creating my world. And he goes on, so you don't miss the point. This is not just some little isolated. He goes on for four chapters like this. And God goes on this rehearsal of his work of creating. And he goes on for four chapters saying, where were you when I made this, when I made that? Do you know how to do this? Do you know anything about creating a world? And he goes through this four chapters of asserting that he is the creator. Now, it's important. In fact, everybody listen up. You've got to hear this. If you miss this, you're going to miss something that is significant. It's important to recognize that in his response to Job, God offers no answers. He answers none of Job's questions. He simply raises his own question. But neither do I think, as I perhaps once did, that God is simply saying, I'm sovereign, so shut up. I don't think that's what Job is saying. Although some people seem to think that's what God is saying, I don't think that's what God is saying. God's four-chapter reply to Job asserts one thing. It has one message, and that message is, I am the creator. I think here's what's going on. Job is presenting a very eloquent complaint. And he's saying, I'm a righteous man, and I've loved God, and I've been faithful to him, and now this has happened. All manner of evil has befallen me. I've lost my wealth, my health, and my family. I think God has some accounting to give for this. And God's reply is basically this. Listen, I am the creator of my world. Make no mistake about it. I am the creator. And if there is something wrong with my world, I will fix it. I think, to take it a little further, I think God is in essence saying to Job, Job, I know there's problems. But I'm the creator. I'm the one responsible. I'm the one that made this. And I'm going to take care of it. But right now, I don't feel like telling you what I'm going to do about it because it's going to be way harder than you think. You have no idea what I'm going to have to do to set this world right, but I'm going to do it. I just want you to know I'm the creator and there's something messed up around here. I know about it, okay? That's God's argument. He's not merely asserting his sovereignty. He is also asserting his responsibility. He's saying, yes, it's my world. And if there's something wrong with it, I'm responsible to fix it. The problem of evil is perhaps the weightiest charge which can be brought against God. Well, let's not dance around this. If you go to a debate between a Christian philosopher and scholar and an atheist, the atheist's greatest weapon is what we call the problem of evil. And it's simply this problem. If God is a good God and he's all powerful, how come babies get brain cancer? How come if God is all powerful and all loving, the world is filled with so much evil and injustice? That's a very weighty argument. Interestingly, the Bible, although obviously aware of the problem, does not offer an explanation to defend God. Well, you know, it's man's free will, or Lucifer sinned in the beginning. The Bible doesn't offer that kind of explanation. What the Bible does do is assert that God is ultimately responsible and he is committed to fix it. So the question posed by Job, posed by millions of suffering people, is this: God, where were you? Come on. Don't shy away from it. God, where were you in the Holocaust? God, where were you in 9/11? God, where were you in the war, in the famine, in the flood, in the tsunami? God, where were you, someone will say, when my parents got divorced? God, where were you when my mom died of cancer? God, where were you when my son was killed in that car wreck? God, where were you when your world is being torn apart and my life is being ruined? Where were you? In Job, we don't find the answer. Only the hint that God knows of his responsibility for his world. But as the Bible continues to tell its long story, we do come to an answer. The answer to the question, where were you, God, when evil was taking its toll upon humanity? Where were you? Listen. Philippians 2:8, the Apostle Paul says, and being found, where were you? And being found in human form, he humbled himself and became obedient to the point of death, even death upon a cross. The phrase sings, you found me lying on the floor, but where were you? God says, you found me hanging upon a cross. Where were you, God, in the Holocaust, 9/11, the tsunami, my parents' divorce? Where were you when my mom's dying of cancer? Where were you when my son was killed in the car wreck? And God can say, I was there, hanging upon a cross. Because the cross is the point where God takes responsibility for his universe. The cross is the point. I got to stress that, the point. And being found in human form, he humbled himself to the point. To the point. Always the ultimate manifestation of evil is death. And he humbled himself to the point of death, even death upon a cross. At the cross, evil is drawn to a single point. All the evil of all the ages is drawn to a single point in the greatest crime of all. Not homicide, the murder of a human. Not fratricide, the murder of a brother. Not patricide, the murder of a father. Not suicide, the murder of self. Not genocide, the murder of a whole people, but deicide, the murder of God. At the cross, all of evil is drawn to a single point, and it's focused on Jesus of Nazareth upon the cross. And it's as if all of the evil of the universe is sucked into that one point, into the person of Jesus. And there is exhausted. Evil pours itself into Jesus at the cross and is absorbed and exhausted. But think about the culmination of evil at the cross. Political evil, represented by Pilate and Herod. Governmental, systematic, tyrannical evil, conspiring to murder God, the righteous one. Religious evil. History is full of a lot of religious abuse. Represented by Caiaphas and Annas, who hide behind their religious cloak to murder the Son of God. But lest we begin to feel too secure ourselves, there's personal evil, represented, yes, by Judas, but also by Peter, who, as the Son of God, is being taken away unjustly for crucifixion. He ultimately then ends up denying him three times. The line separating good and evil does not run nicely and neatly between groups of people, political parties, nations and states, as if we can defeat evil by just calling them evildoers and go drop bombs on their head and we'll be rid of evil. It doesn't work that way. The line of evil runs right through my own heart. And if I'm begging God to rid the world of evil, I better be careful what I'm saying, because he might start with me. He might say, oh, little man, I think I'll start with you. Bang, there I go. At the cross, we see this culmination of political evil, Pilate and Herod, and religious evil, Caiaphas and Annas, personal evil, Judas and Peter too. And behind it all, demonic evil. Because at every stage, operating behind Pilate and Herod and Caiaphas and Annas, Satan is entering Judas, and Jesus is warning Peter. Satan has demanded sift you like wheat. So it's all there: political, religious, personal, demonic evil. Yes, evil came to a single point at the cross and rushed into Jesus Christ, where it was absorbed and exhausted. The cross is a mystery, but it's like a black hole. You know about the black holes in space. It's like a black hole just sucking the evil of this universe into it. Coalesced, concentrated in one point. The cross is sucking like a black hole just all the evil of the universe into it. Interestingly, many physicists believe that a black hole is also a wormhole leading to another world, that on the other side there would be a white hole spewing forth light. That's the cross. In a broken world, it's a black hole sucking the evil into itself with no rebound, but absorbing the blow until sin has exhausted itself. But it's also the portal into God's new creation world, spewing forth light. Where were you? Where were you? On the cross. On the cross. Job would have to wait. Job says, where were you, God? I lost my family, and I lost my health, and I lost my fortune. I lost everything. Where were you? God says, shh, I'm the creator. I know there's evil. I know there's sin. I know there's suffering. I know there's pain. I know there's injustice. Shh. I know I'm responsible for my creation. Where were you? Now God says, and he was found in human form. And he humbled himself and became obedient to the point of death, even death on a cross, sucking the evil and the sin and the pain and the suffering of this world into his own self, that he might open up the way to a new world. As Dietrich Bonhoeffer says, only the suffering God can help. God does not stand aloof to the problem of evil, pain, and suffering. God is found in human form, absorbing evil at the point of the cross. That's why I say that the cross is both the ugliest thing and the most beautiful thing in all of the universe. There's two sides to the cross. There's the black hole side, where an innocent man is being tortured to death in a state-sponsored execution. And his body has been mutilated, and he's being mocked and spit upon. It's horribly ugly. And yet it's from that that we see the greatest demonstration of God's love. Taking the blow himself. Taking the blame himself. If someone is inclined as a critic, as a cynic, as a skeptic to protest and say God should be held responsible for the evil of his creation, I say, and God has served his sentence. And he has taken the blow. And at the cross, we find a portal to a new world. A new creation. It's now and not yet. I know. We don't see it all. There's a timelessness to the cross. I know it's a historic event 2,000 years ago. I know we don't see all evil removed from this world. I'm perfectly aware of that. And yet, there's the prophetic vision of Revelation 21 and 22. Of no more pain. And no more sickness. And no more sorrow. No more death. And a world made right. And that comes about because of the accomplishment of the cross. Where the righteous one, the holy one, the innocent one, the one infinitely more righteous and innocent than Job, hangs upon a cross and says, Father, forgive them. When it comes to the concept of evil, we want there to be the elimination of evil from our world so that there's no more pain, sorrow, and suffering. When it comes to ridding the world of evil, let's get rid of the evildoers, we invariably attempt to divide the world into some form of us and them. I'm going to suggest that from your vantage point, every division of the world into us and them is a false division. There's only one valid division of us and them in the realm of evil, and it's the Trinity and humanity. The Trinity is holy. Humanity is evil. And so the representative of the Trinity, Jesus, the Son of God, hangs upon the cross and he says, Father, forgive them. He takes the blow. He absorbs the evil. And he doesn't say, hit him back, God. He doesn't say, avenge me. He says, Father, forgive them. And the cross is where evil goes to die. To exhaust itself, to be spent, and found no more. Blessed be the name of the Lord. Where were you? On the cross. We all know that we live in a world corrupted by evil. But what I want to remind you today, and what Job came very close to forgetting, and it's easy to forget sometimes in our pain, is that evil is not just out there. Evil is also in here. But by coming to Jesus Christ in the faith that He died upon the cross for our sins, you can find forgiveness and the beginning of God's new creation. Evil will be sucked out of God's good creation. The only question is, will you pass through into God's new creation? Will you come to the cross, through the cross, into the garden, into resurrection, into newness of life? And that's what I want to invite you to do this morning, is to believe and to act upon your faith. And to come with your sin, to come with your suffering, to come with your sorrow, to come with your pain, to come in faith to Jesus Christ at the cross, and let that sin, that sorrow, that suffering, that pain be absorbed by the cross and taken out of you. Taken out of you. By faith to touch the cross. By faith to connect yourself with that point where Jesus absorbed the evil of this universe. To by faith believe in Jesus Christ and His death upon the cross. And let your sin, your sorrow, your pain, your suffering be taken out of you. And then pass through to a new creation. If anyone is in Christ, behold, it's a new world. You've passed through, as Jesus says, from death to life. Amen. Would you bow your heads? I'm going to invite you. I have the privilege of inviting you, of preaching the gospel, and inviting you to connect your life by faith, by simply believing, to the point of the cross. What are you to believe? You're to believe that Jesus died for you. That Jesus absorbs not just evil, your evil. Not just sin, your sin. Not just sorrow, pain, and suffering, but your sorrow, pain, and suffering. He takes it upon Himself. He absorbs it into His own self at the cross. And the cross becomes the doorway. The physicists would say the wormhole, the white hole. The Bible calls it the door, the way, the truth, the life into God's new set world, set right world. Ah. But just in this moment, let's not talk about the whole wide world. Let's talk about you, your sin, your sorrow, your suffering, your pain, your shame. Will you, by faith, connect your life at the point of the cross, that your sin, your sorrow, your pain, your shame might be taken out of you, and that you might pass from the old life to the new? With your heads bowed and your eyes closed, I'm going to ask you in just a moment, if you want to make that faith connection, I'm going to ask you to raise your hand. It's a moment of encounter with Jesus Christ. If you've not done something definite to encounter Jesus Christ, it's been on the periphery, you've thought about it. Maybe you've never thought about it, but you're thinking about it now. I'm going to ask you in just a moment to do something definite and deliberate and to raise your hand.